This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
It's setting a very dangerous precedent in what Gambians are terming as a new democracy.
That's activist Lamine Tamba talking about a military court's decision to find soldiers guilty of plotting to overthrow the Gambian government in 2017. Also, Malawi's President Peter Mutharika is sworn in to a second term, although the opposition says it may challenge the presidential election result. And a two-day strike protesting the ruling of the military council and its hold on power begins in Sudan. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Malawi's President Peter Mutharika was sworn in to another five-year term today. During the ceremony, he called on opposition parties to accept the election results. Opposition candidate Lazarus Chakwera and his Malawi Congress Party have said they plan to challenge the results of the May 21st presidential election. VOA has been told that the party's legal team is meeting to decide what to do next. On Monday, Justice Jane Ansa, chair of the Malawi Electoral Commission, announced the presidential election results. The announcement came after a court lifted an order preventing the commission from issuing its ballot count. Mutharika received 38.6% of the vote, while opposition candidate Chakwera received 35.4%. Another candidate, Saulos Chilima, won 20.2% of the vote. In Malawi's election system, the president may be elected with a plurality rather than a majority of the vote. Sudanese workers launched a two-day nationwide strike today. An alliance of unions, professional organizations, and political parties called the strike to pressure the ruling military council to hand power to a civilian authority. Talks between the alliance and the military council, which took power in an April coup, have deadlocked for weeks. For VOA, Jason Patinkin talks to striking workers in the streets of Khartoum.
Chanting anti-government slogans, workers demanding an end to military rule lined up outside the upscale Al-Waha shopping center in downtown Khartoum. Our martyrs lost their lives. We can lose our jobs, they said, referring to the dozens of people killed since December in Sudan's revolution. Tuesday is the first day of a two-day nationwide strike, called by opposition leaders demanding Sudan's military junta hand the government to civilians. The junta took power in April following the ouster of longtime President Omar al-Bashir after months of street protests. Bashir had ruled for nearly 30 years and was accused of human rights abuses and corruption. Talks between protest leaders and the military council collapsed earlier this month after soldiers attacked peaceful demonstrators in the city, killing several and wounding hundreds. Leaders of the protest movement said they are escalating their actions to pressure the military to give up power. A teller at the Bank of Khartoum's Al-Wafa Mall branch, Idris Ibrahim, said the Sudanese people are growing impatient. He says they want a civilian government. The military council has had the country for almost 50 days now. We have had negotiations, but they do not seem to want to give us our civilian government. Only one group in the opposition alliance, the Umma Party, led by former Sudanese Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi, refused to participate in the strike, but that seemed to have little effect. Around the nation, workers in various sectors posted photos of themselves on social media holding signs supporting the strike. Oil workers, dentists, sugar processing employees, cement factory workers, and veterinarians were some of the sectors involved. Numerous international flights to Sudan were also canceled as aviation employees threatened to strike. Ibrahim said the upper management of his bank was totally against the strike. A few steps away, his colleague Susanna Abdallah Hassan said she did not care what the bosses thought.
I don't care.
She says she does not care. Even if she is fired, she says it is a small tax for the country. There are people who have lost their lives. The job is nothing, she added. Inside the mall, many shops remained open, but employees supported the strike by refusing to work. At a shop of the MTN mobile phone company, staff politely turned away any potential customers at the door, handing small pieces of paper explaining their support for the strike. At the Sena supermarket, employees lined shopping carts to block shoppers from entering. Throughout Khartoum, most businesses appeared shuttered. There were no reports of violence from protesters, but members of the military council earlier vowed to fire any striking government workers. Video circulated on social media Tuesday appeared to show uniformed security officers arresting staff of an electricity utility. Sudanese electricians had otherwise downed their tools, but said they would ensure power supply to necessary services such as hospitals. Sudan Professionals Association spokesman Amjad Farid condemns the alleged arrests, which he described as illegitimate. He said arrests of workers were a clear violation of their right of political freedom of association. Farid said if the military does not hand power to civilians after the strike ends Wednesday, the opposition alliance will call for further civil disobedience. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Today is Menstrual Hygiene Day. It's a day that advocates for women and girls worldwide have set aside to challenge cultural taboos around menstruation, promote access to sanitary pads and other products, and empower girls and women with accurate information about sexual reproductive health. VOA's Adam Phillips has this report on what one organization is doing to help.
In Kenya, 2 out of 3 women and girls cannot use sanitary pads, either because they can't afford them or none are available. That's why Zana Africa has distributed them free to over 50,000 Kenyan schoolgirls since 2009. Allison Nakamura, the executive director of the Zana Africa Foundation, explains why sanitary pads are so important.
So one, if you're bleeding and can't control the blood, there's like a yuck factor to that, right? So you're staining your clothes. If you don't have access to clean running water, perhaps you can't, you know, then wash your clothes. If you have one school uniform or one pair of underpants, you might ruin those things and then your clothes are soiled. So it just really can't manage a very natural process, and that really interferes with your self-confidence and your dignity and your health overall.
Indeed, girls also need sanitary pads simply for hygiene.
If you don't have access to sanitary pads, you end up using, say, homemade materials like cloth or, in some cases, cotton that comes out of a mattress or a dirty rag, and then putting that in a part of your body that really shouldn't be exposed to germs then, of course, could lead to infections or cause girls to kind of stay home and just really not fulfill their potential.
Along with menstrual products, Zana Africa distributes Neotine, a colorful magazine about health and life skills. Nia is the Swahili word for purpose.
So it's 5 issues, and it goes through reproductive health education, it goes through power dynamics, it goes through consent, it goes through friendship, career, really unpacking for girls all of the kind of joys and challenges of growing up, as we say.
Zana Africa also provides community mentors who visit school clubs and other small groups where sexuality, peer pressure, teen pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, and many other topics can be safely discussed. Joyce Mudia is the program coordinator in Kilifi on the Kenyan coast.
A safe space is a space where girls can express themselves. The questions they ask, regardless of their nature, can be responded to in an honest manner using factual information.
Mentors are trained not to impose their own values on the girls by telling them what they should or should not do. It takes work to remain neutral in a culture where elders are expected to advise and lead, and youth are expected to listen and obey. Mabuji says that Nia teen groups examine gender stereotypes such as, for example, that girls should be passive in their relationships with boys and men.
Also, there's a topic on power. What is power? What does power mean to you? And what is the relationship of power and gender when it comes to relationship and to choices regarding what to do with their own bodies or their own lives?
Forced marriage and sexual violence are also addressed. The organization's staff believe that when girls and women are able to achieve their full potential, the entire community benefits. That's why Zana Africa works to bring everyone, parents, elders, educators, health professionals, policymakers, and boys into the conversation on Menstrual Hygiene Day and beyond. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. At 16 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Sudanese workers launch a two-day strike to pressure the military government to hand over power to a civilian authority. In Malawi, Peter Mutharika is sworn in as president, although the opposition threatens to dispute his election. And advocates are bringing attention to Menstrual Hygiene Day to promote women's health. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The United Nations says about 2 billion people around the world lack access to solid waste collection services, while 3 billion others do not have access to controlled waste disposal facilities. Officials and participants at the first UN Habitat Assembly in Nairobi say providing of urban services is crucial to creating a better quality of life for citizens. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chiama reports.
Health and planning officials say safely clearing cities and neighborhoods of trash is crucial in preventing a dramatic rise in global pollution. UN Habitat Executive Director Maimouna Mohamed Sharif says rapid urbanization is exacerbating the problem.
Every week, 3 million people move from rural areas to town and cities. So by 2050, we will have an additional 2.5 billion urban dwellers, and a vast majority of them in Africa, in Asia. So this means that the urban growth is happening fastest in the developing countries, where governments and institutions are often least able to cope. So we are here for 1 week, looking for solution, discussion, networking, looking for best practices so that we can engage and we can learn and relearn.
Sharif spoke on the sidelines of the first UN Habitat Assembly being held this week in Nairobi. The assembly focuses on finding innovative ways to improve urban life. Besides the main conference, there are various side events, including the Urban Expo, featuring innovations from more than 40 companies. Participants are calling for collective action to address the challenges of rapid urbanization. Dr. Jenny Moore is the Institute Director for Sustainability at the British Columbia Institute of Technology.
For us, we're working with the EcoCity Standards. It's a tool that we've developed in collaboration with communities around the world to help people understand what are the issues that they're facing with right now and what ideas have already come up from other communities that are solving some of those challenges. So the EcoCity Standards is really a learning tool to help point to resources and success stories from other places that could be transferred.
Moore says there are some success stories.
For example, in Cairo, there's a community that was having trouble with water, concerned that there were contaminants in the water from the city distribution system, and the water was clean at the utility. So somewhere between the utility and the house, the water was being contaminated. So EcoCity Builders partnered with an academic institution, a faculty member, and students went out and worked with the community, sampled the water, and located where the leak was happening. And then we're able to work with the utility to fix it.
Another participant is Brian Chege, co-founder of Green Hub, a Kenyan design consulting firm that incorporates technology into building and construction.
The idea, well, came from our founder, where he was installing a solar system to a house, and he realized that the roof design of the house could not hold the weight. Realized that most of these new solutions that are coming into the market, design-wise, were not factored in. So looking at that, we took a proactive approach and set up a space where now we'd have these solutions already incorporated in the designs. And also looking at it largely, you'll find that there's a global shift towards green and sustainable buildings. And so we took it upon ourselves to actually see how can we get it rolling here in our own way.
The week-long global assembly has attracted more than 3,000 delegates, among them ministers and high-level government representatives from 116 countries and civil society groups. A ministerial declaration is expected on Friday. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
In the Gambia, a military court has sentenced seven soldiers and army officers to 9 years in prison for plotting to overthrow the government of President Adama Barrow back in 2017. One soldier was handed a 3-year jail term. The court martial had also acquitted four soldiers for lack of evidence. Reporter Patton Derimbai has more.
The sentence in Monday ends a court-martial trial that had lasted nearly 2 years. The 8 soldiers and officers of the Gambia Armed Forces were accused of conspiring in 2017 to overthrow the democratically elected government of President Adama Barrow. The ringleader of the aborted coup is Army Captain Yaya Bire Jame. Jame is a former aide-de-camp to his namesake, the former Gambian leader Yaya Jame. He and his co-defendants were accused of using the social media app, WhatsApp, to plot to topple the Barrow government. The army spokesperson, Major Lamin K. Sanyang, tells VOA that the court's verdict confirms the independence and the effectiveness of the Gambian legal system. But Gambian political activist Lamin Tamba in the United Kingdom disagrees.
The PRO would say it was a free and fair trial. In his perverted view, whatever lens he took to look at this matter, he's looked at it from the wrong angle. It was not free and fair. You can't torture people and admit to torture. In fact, the army said they were disappointed that there was torture of one of the witnesses. So you cannot torture people and force them to write statements and call that a free and fair process. Never. It doesn't happen in any part of the world.
One of the defendants, Lance Corporal Sambujan Bojang, said he was tortured while being interrogated by the personnel of the defunct National Intelligence Agency, now renamed as the State Intelligence Services, SIS. The court-martial acquitted Bojang and 3 other soldiers, saying the prosecution could not prove its case against them. Political activist Lamin Tamba says the evidence in the court-martial was not enough to convict any of the accused.
For the court-martial, which is, by the way, an extension of the High Court, but just the military version of it, for them to find these officers guilty of plotting to overthrow the government based on witness statements alone, when it was actually an allegation that they wanted to throw the government based on their conversations in a WhatsApp chat group, is dangerous. It's setting a very dangerous precedent in what Gambians are terming as a new democracy, a new dispensation in our country.
Tamba argues that the government's move to police social media amounts to invasion of privacy. He says Gambian social media users have good reasons to be worried about their privacy in view of the soldier's conviction. The president of the court-martial, Colonel Sally Bojang, says the decision to convict the accused soldiers was a unanimous one. He also says the court had taken into consideration the time already served by the convicts prior to Monday's sentencing. The court ruled the men had planned to arrest Gambia's Army Chief of Defense Staff, cabinet ministers, and battalion commanders. Also Monday, the court martial freed 2 Gambian Army Brigadier Generals who were accused of desertion. The court ruled there was not enough evidence to hold General Umpa Mendi and General Anshumana Tamba. For VOA Africa, this is Pan Derimbai reporting.
The Veterinary doctor Karen Lawrence has become known as Africa's pangolin doctor for leading medical efforts to help the scaly anteaters rescued from the illegal wildlife trade. Her pioneering tube feeding and blood testing is helping to improve her endangered patients' survival rate. Marisa de Klerk reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
And if you look at his feet, it's one of the ways we know how long they've been in captivity. His feet are nice and hard.
This endangered ground pangolin, one of the species found in South and Eastern Africa, is lucky. He's one of 50 pangolins rescued this year from wildlife traffickers and put in the care of veterinarian Dr. Karen Lawrence. Her groundbreaking medical care for the scaly anteaters means he's more likely to soon be back in his natural habitat.
Very little is known about the Temex ground pangolin. They've already had this poaching epidemic in Asia for quite a long time, so they've had lots of time to do research on theirs, whereas we get one at a time. Asian pangolins in captivity will eat out of a bowl. Ours do not. They have to be taken out into their natural environment and followed almost while they feed.
Dr. Lawrence's team pioneered a tube feeding method with low-fat, high-protein cat food to keep rescued pangolins alive and recovering. Her blood testing research has made it easier to tailor treatment plans for each pangolin. The director of the Center for Veterinary Wildlife Science at the University of Pretoria, Professor Leith Meyer, says Dr. Lawrence's work is far-reaching.
She's discovering really important treatments. She's discovering very important things about their normal physiology, how their normal body works, and that all allows her and will allow other people in the world to then better treat their pangolins.
Nikki Wright is with the African Pangolin Working Group and Humane Society International. She says in Africa, conserving pangolins is not just about stopping poachers.
We need all the different aspects, and at this point the most important one is the veterinary treatment.
Pangolins receiving specialist treatment in South Africa have been doing well, says the chairperson of the African Pangolin Working Group, Professor Raymond Janssen.
If we get them early enough, our success rate is out of the hospital more than 90%. So we monitor them for up to a year following their release, and their success rate is about 75%.
Pangolins are one of the most trafficked animals. With Dr. Lawrence's help, it may just be possible to prevent this gentle creature from being completely wiped out. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to The Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, we all thank you for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports.
Mm.
Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC.